Hello, members. This is Past Free coming to you live and direct from the 10-10-10 and reaching out to the members of EBC3. Happy to bring you another weekly Bible study podcast. And I'm here with Reverend Torrence Spears, who will be sharing the Bible study discussion with me today. If I were to give this lesson a title, it would be A Giant in the Valley. I want to share a familiar story from 1 Samuel chapter 17. So if you'll get your Bibles and smart devices ready and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17, I'm going to read the entire chapter because it captures the entire story. It's a familiar story, and I just thought it was a timely story. Some of the elements in the story, I think, are relevant to what we're experiencing today. So I'm going to toss it to Reverend Spears and let him give greetings to you, and then we'll begin our study.
Greetings to you, Ebenezer, and thank you again, Dr. Freeman, for allowing me to join in with you in discussing the Bible study today. I think it should be an interesting lesson to all of our listeners, and especially to our youth and young adults, some of which have been listening in. So shout out and kudos to you. And I'm interested to see where this is going to take us.
All right. This lesson, I think, would be especially helpful to our youth and young adults because the main character in the lesson, well, at least one of the main characters, is David, who's a youth or a young adult at this time. And I think that it speaks to some of the decisions that young people make and face, as opposed to some of the decisions that older persons make and face. So if you will turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17, and I'm going to read the entire chapter. It's a pretty long chapter, so stay with me, bear with me as I read through it. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephesdamim. Saul and the Israelites gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and formed ranks against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had greaves of bronze on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up water for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "Today I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So that's the first section of the story, confrontation between the Israelites and the Philistines, and then the Philistine champion, Goliath, telling the Israelites to send somebody to face him. But there's another part of the story, beginning in verse 12. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 eldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. Jesse said to his son David, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See how your brothers fare and bring me some token from them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, took the provisions, and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the encampment as the army was going forth to the battle line, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage, ran to the ranks, and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before, and David heard them. All the Israelites, when they saw the man, fled from him and were very much afraid. The Israelites said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. The king will greatly enrich the man who kills him, and will give him his daughter and make his family free in Israel. David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? The people answered him in the same way. So shall it be done for the man who kills him? His elder brother Eliab heard him talking to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. He said, why have you come down? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down just to see the battle. David said, what have I done now? It was only a question. He turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. Saul said to David, let no one's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go. David said to Saul, to the king, let no one's heart fail because of him, speaking of Goliath. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Saul said to David, you're not able to go up against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are just a boy, and he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and whenever a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went after it and struck it down, rescuing the lamb from its mouth. And if it turned against me, I would catch it by the jaw, strike it down, and kill it. Your servant has killed both lions and bears. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, since he has defied the armies of the living God. David said, the Lord who saved me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will save me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul said to David, go, and may the Lord be with you. Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. David strapped Saul's sword over the armor, and he tried in vain to walk, for he was not used to them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot walk with these, for I am not used to them. So David removed them. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the wadi and put them in his shepherd's bag in the pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. The Philistine came on and drew near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the wild animals of the field. But David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the Philistine army this very day to the birds of the air and to the wild animals of the earth, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not save by sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. Wow, what words from a young person. When the Philistine drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, slung it, and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, striking down the Philistine and killing him. There was no sword in David's hand. And David ran and stood over the Philistine. He grasped his sword, drew it out of his sheath, and killed him. Then he cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The troops of Israel and Judah rose up with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sherem as far as Gath and Ekron. The Israelites came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." The king said, "Inquire whose son the stripling is." On David's return from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Wow, what a story.
What a long story.
And I know, I know it was a long story, but it captures the full account of what happens in this tale that is shared to us by the Jewish people. I find it to be a very striking story. One of my friends was out walking the other evening, a friend in Illinois, and he said that he had planned to do his walk before it got dark, but he left home a little late and was walking home, and it was dark. He was about a couple of blocks from his house, and he saw something come out of the bushes, green space near where he lives, and he thought it was a deer. And then when he kept looking, he found out that it was a coyote, and not only one coyote, but two coyotes. He said it scared the mess out of him, and he was trying to figure out how he was going to get home, and he had nothing in his hand. He didn't want to run, and he just said they walked in the middle of the street and kept his eye on the coyotes, and eventually they went back into to the woods, and he was able to get home. So thinking about him being scared to death of these coyotes, and here is David in this story talking about a lion and a bear attacking his flock and grabbing them by the jaw and killing them. It's just incredible. What do you think?
I think it's a good reminder of what David is saying in Psalm 23, you know, that you walk through this valley of shadow of death, but even then a good shepherd is going to provide for his flock. And so the personal experience that David gets here gives him a better understanding of who God is.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting. I think it's a good story. You should become a professional reader. You do great. You don't stumble over your words or anything. You know, this is wonderful.
Let that be a lesson for you.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Thank you very much. I take that into consideration.
This story is about some of the land wars between Israel and the Philistines. And of course, as Israel continues to expand, she runs into enemies, the enemies of the people and the enemies of God. And it's a story about a typical battle. The text says that Israel was gathered up on one side of the mountain and the Philistines were gathered up on the other side of the mountain. And they were trying to figure out what was the best strategy for this this battle?
Well, you use language there, and just so that I'm a sounding board, I guess, against what you're saying, but it depends on which side you take to choose, right? So the Israelites are calling these people that they're coming against their enemies, but these people are already stationed there. That's their home.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, they're going to fight back, and you come in and you say, well, we're the people of God and God gave us this land.
Yeah.
I think it's important for you and for us to see both sides of the story. You know, this is the Israelic story. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody buys into that that narrative.
Mm, what a word. Yeah, you're right. I think that the story we have here is presented to us by the Israelite people. So they're telling their story,
mm-hmm.
and it's told from their perspective, their faith story. So, you know, we might think of it as being a story about good versus evil. But as you're saying, who's going to be good? Who's going to be evil? Are the Philistines evil because they want to protect their land? Are the Israelites good because they say God has given them this land and they want to go and increase their territory? So it doesn't always follow that what the groups we think are good are good. The groups that we think are evil are evil. Another thing that I see in the story are the complexities of war, fear, supplies, provisions, and even capability. Because you see that when Goliath comes and presents himself to the Israelites, the people and the men in the army become fearful. They look at how big he is. He had to be between 6 and 7 feet tall, according to some sources. And then he has all this big, heavy equipment on. It comes out like some big old giant, hence my title, A Giant in the Valley. And so even though men are and women today are in the armed forces and they're going and fighting, doesn't mean that they are always brave. That sometimes they might be scared, they might be worried. And then you see David bringing supplies to the camp. So he goes from home. He takes food, provisions, and other supplies to his brothers and to the camp. And so it's a story about the supplies and the provisions, having all that. And then the issue of capability.
Mm-hmm.
Is our army strong enough to fight your army? Do we have the capacity to meet this issue? And then another issue in the story has to do with the families that are left behind. Because when Jesse sends David, Jesse tells David, go check on your brothers and come back and tell me how they're doing. So, you know, sometimes people are out there fighting in our behalf and on the front lines for us, and they have families at home who are worried about them and concerned about them. Thoughts on that?
No, I don't really have any thoughts on that.
All right. And then, so let's look at this Goliath, sort of the ace in the hole for the Philistines. It's almost like, you know, sometimes countries will hire trained mercenaries, these trained killers, these trained soldiers to go in on a special mission. We see that in some of the movies that we have watched from Hollywood. Goliath is sort of like a missionary in the tradition of a mercenary. He is, he's big, he's menacing, he's powerful, he comes out and he taunts the Israelites, often in order to avoid a protracted war. Countries would send a man out to represent them from the army, and it would be a one-on-one, man-to-man conflict, and whichever one prevailed would represent success for their country.
A parlay, so to speak.
Yes, and Goliath is sort of speaking in that tradition, so it's not unusual that Goliath comes out and says, send a man out, because Goliath says, if you kill me, we'll be your servants, and send a man out. But because he's so big, And because he's so menacing, nobody wants to go out there and face this this big bully.
You call him a bully?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he comes out there and sort of taunts them. You know, it's like he's saying, I dare you to send somebody out here to try to whoop me. And I'm going to tear you guys apart. So sort of the bully, the way he's talking to them.
Bully-ish. I mean, but it's war.
Yeah.
And this is a man who's killed, I'm sure, hundreds, if not thousands, of people.
Yeah.
And so he has a confidence about his war tactics.
So he shouldn't be coming out talking sweet.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, our president does it.
Oh.
Right? Our country does it. When we look at other countries, even and we may do it subconsciously. No country is going to come in and defeat us, and nobody can mess with America. Nobody can overpower our armies. We have the most powerful armies in the world, and the most powerful navy, and all this stuff. And we spend trillions of dollars on war efforts. So I believe that it's
so. You
just
think it's just that America can be like a bully?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, if you're saying by your own definition, the way that we talk and the way that we interact with other persons or countries in that matter, I have a friend that's from Germany, and when he comes, I tease him. Even when we're talking on Skype, he was a foreign exchange student in high school, and I mess with him all the time about Germany can't mess with America.
Yeah,
and this type of stuff, and it's a ongoing tease that we have with one another. But I think that we have that perspective, and I think the world has that perspective of us that we are we're arrogant people.
Yeah, you think about some of the things that our president did at some of the summits that he attended with other world leaders. Jockeying for position for some of the photo ops and some of the comments that he would make at press conferences, basically trying to send them, and then the handshake between him and Macron, and send the message that you're not going to dominate me. You're not going to take my dominance away. I'm going to be the dominant one, and I have to be in the position of power and be in the position of authority over you.
Well, I think the image is with him at NATO.
Yeah.
And for, like you said, for the photo opportunity that they were getting ready to have, Trump is kind of behind a few of the world leaders. And so he walks to the front of the line and pushes the man out the way to be in front of the picture. Yeah. And I said, oh my God, you know, but, I think that the world can see us as arrogant
people. And I think also what you mentioned earlier, it has to do with rhetoric. It has to do with what we say. The tone of what we say, the content, can send the message that we're a bully nation, and we want to bully other nations. And then I guess that sort of goes to the, what are you going to say?
Well, I'm trying not to skip ahead, but if we are comparing, and I know that this is not, well, I don't know if this is your intention, but if we are comparing America to a bully, then there's a Goliath out there for us, isn't there?
Well, that is where I'm headed to what the Goliath is. We'll just talk about it later. And then I think it sort of shows the imbalance between combatants. You got Israel on one side, you got the Philistines on the other side, and you have Goliath. And then all of a sudden there's this imbalance, and the Israelite army just stands there frozen on the side, not able to do something about it. And then here comes this young man. Here comes David, Jesse's youngest son, and he comes on a mission from his dad, bringing provisions to his brothers. But while he's there, he wants to find out what's going on, and so he begins to inquire about the battle. He hears Goliath taunting the Israelite army, and his brother Eliab basically says, "You know, what are you doing here, knucklehead? And why are you sitting around asking people questions and everything? You know, basically, why should you go back home?" And of course, David doesn't back down. He says, "And why can't I ask questions? Why can't I?" He just goes on to answer more questions. And then David says that he's willing to go out there and face Goliath, and declares to the king, you know, if you can't find a man to go out there and fight, I'll go out there and fight him. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking the question: is this arrogance? Is it courage? Is it faith? And I know that it's obvious that it's faith, because David really in his speech says, you know, you define the armies of our God, and God is going to give us the victory. That's what he basically says. But what do you think about this young man coming to the battle to bring provisions, and then deciding that he's going to go to one man on man with Goliath?
I don't think of it as an arrogance situation or mindset. A parallel to maybe something that is going on is that what he has at the forefront of his mind is his nation is in trouble.
Okay.
And so in some sense, I would almost say that it's a humility. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I have nothing else to lose.
Yeah.
If we're overtaken by this giant, and if nobody else wants to face him, then I'm left with nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so why not go ahead and give my life, even if I don't win,
but
I would have done something.
Does he know what he's facing, though?
But does it matter?
Does he understand all the implications of what he's doing?
What would be the other implication?
Yeah.
It's either you go and put yourself out there because nobody else was doing it, right? Nobody else wanted to face Goliath. So, I mean, do you just turn over for the enemy? Do you just lose and then surrender? Or do you say, well, I'm going to give my best shot?
Yeah.
And the only way to do that is to muster up the courage and go out there and do what I have to do, lose or win.
Yeah.
It's the last thing that it's like the last stand, right?
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point. I think that it's not about him being arrogant or being bold. I don't even think it's about him necessarily being courageous. I think your point about the nation, he sees Goliath as a threat to the Israelite people. He sees Goliath as a threat to the nation, and he's loyal to Israel. He's loyal to the God of Israel and says, no. It doesn't matter what he says, doesn't matter what he looks like, doesn't matter what he's done. He's coming against our nation. He's coming against our people. I think that some of the people who've been a part of the protests have the same thought in mind. You know, this is not just about something that happened to George Floyd. This is something that happens to African Americans all the time. This is something that happens to people. And we've got to do something about it. It's hitting all of us. It's going to impact all of us, and so they feel some level of responsibility to be involved.
There's I want to comment on that, but I want to finish my thought with the humility aspect of it, and that is he says, and you already stated this, that God is going to fight this battle,
right?
And that's how the King James words it. That this is God's battle,
yeah,
and not yours. And so, in some sense, David is saying, I have nothing. You know, I it's not me that's going to win this, but it's God that's fighting this. And so that's why I'm thinking of it as in a humility standpoint, instead of thinking of it as an arrogance or even, like you said, courageous. But going to your other point, you know, I realize now that not everybody thinks about George Floyd in the light of him being a martyr.
Yes.
There's a young lady I was listening to a podcast yesterday night or last night, and she, I think her name is Candace Owens or something like that. She's a black woman, young, very young, and she, comparatively speaking to yourself, you know, she's very young. And she is a Republican, and she doesn't believe that George Floyd is worth saying, making all this ruckus about. That's what she kind of says. And so I'm realizing now that people can have a different perspective of the story. And that's what we kind of started out saying about this. Everybody's not going to agree with there needing to be a change.
Yeah. Someone in my family sent me a text message comparing George Floyd's suffering to the suffering of Jesus. Mm. And I sent the text back and said, George Floyd wasn't Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I said, he was mistreated, he was violated, he was murdered, but that doesn't make him a saint. That doesn't make him a martyr either. This is just something that occurred in his life. I think that people are exploiting this. Some people are exploiting it for attention, for the mileage they can get out of it as politicians. I think it sometimes the attention sort of drowns out the larger issue, and that's the issue of racism and injustice, the issue of police brutality. Those are the main issues that come out of this. That it could have been George Floyd, it could have been anybody, it could have happened to anybody. So I think so. But anyway, let's sort of move on, because it struck me, Torrance, that when David goes to King Saul, first David, Saul says, "You're a young man, so you know what can you do? This is an experienced warrior." But David sort of persists, and Saul lets him go and puts his gear on him. And I was like, you know, well, why would the king let a young man go out there against this warrior? And why would the other men in the army stand by and let why don't his brothers, you know, try to dissuade him from going? Why doesn't somebody intervene? It just struck me that they would let this young man go out there. But folk will put you out there. They'll put you on the front lines. Maybe I have, you know, a narrow view of that. What do you think about that?
Well, no, I think I think it's the right perspective, because it kind of completes my thought process on my last what I was saying, the last example that I was giving about this woman and her podcast not agreeing about the story of George Floyd. And that is, everybody may not have the same perspective on how this goes about. And the same thing within this story. Not everybody had the humility or even the courage to go and face this man. They had nothing.
Yeah.
They were just afraid.
Yeah.
And there are people that are like that, even in our country and in our time. They don't want to have anything to do with what's going on right now. Even if they disagree wholeheartedly about making George the center focus of this, or black people in general the center focus of this, I think that there are people that just rather keep their hands off of it and say, whatever happens, happens. We can't change anything.
Yeah.
And I think that these men were standing and they saw this over 7 foot giant, and they said, there's nothing that we can do, and we're not equipped to handle it, and he can kill us in one blow. So, no, it's not for me.
And just let him go on out there.
I mean, it. Yeah.
Yeah. That I never read the story that way. When I was younger, and thank God that God has allowed me to live get to the age that I am, because many are denied the privilege.
Yeah, well, you're that age.
Many are denied the privilege.
Yeah, bless your heart.
But anyway, that Saul and them will let him go out, but hope will put you out there. But here in this story, success comes from an unexpected source. Instead of some major warrior from the Israelite camp going out and defeating Goliath, David goes out there, and here this, he wasn't even a trained soldier. He just shows up to the battlefield. He just shows up one day, and he becomes a source of success. And even the thing of his success, it wasn't unusual for, warriors, to use, slingshots and stones in battles. That wasn't unusual, but he uses a slingshot and a stone and fells this giant. He hits him in the head, drops him to the ground, and success comes from an unexpected source.
Well, let me go back to your last point, and well, in this point as well, putting you out there. What if they let him go to see if the Philistines would would show mercy. Does that make sense?
Well, it's a possibility because it's unlikely.
Well, I know it's unlikely, but you know we have, and I'm just trying to think of situations and not be too political about it. But you look at these young people that go to the UN and stand before these countries and these heads of state. And they know that they could be ridiculed or just blown off. But I think the countries send them because they know that the kids have something powerful to say. Right. And so just that stand. So maybe they'll let them go because they were touched. Maybe they said to themselves, I didn't have the courage to do that. And this is a powerful show. And maybe they had hope in him. Mm. Maybe they said, you know, nothing else is working, so why not?
Yeah. I don't know if I let my younger brother go out there and I'm standing on the sidelines. Yeah. I don't know if I could do that, but I understand your point because sometimes people look at a young person and say, well, I can't treat this young person like I'm treating the rest of these adults. Mm-hmm. And there's this other thing in the story as we sort of move toward a close. You have the older people in the army who are standing on the sidelines. And then you have this young man who is out there in the valley, who goes down into the valley with Goliath. Sometimes, you know, older people are a little more reticent to go and protest and go into battles. Many have done it before in their youth, but then you have young people who is it blind belief or is it determination of millennials and young people? Who will go out there and protest and walk and do all that. A lot of people, including myself, wanted to go and participate in the protest.
Yeah, you said that.
But a lot of people said, well, I don't want to be in the crowd with the coronavirus. I don't want to be around a lot of people because the potential of having the coronavirus. And then also, we can't control what the crowd might do. The crowd might become violent. The crowd might become destructive. We saw that happening. And so a lot of older people said, I'm with them. I feel the need for the protest. I'm with them, but I don't want to go out. I'm reluctant. And then you have young people say, I don't care. I'm putting my mask on. And I'm going out there.
You know, it just occurred to me that the same way young people may inspire governments and leadership, I think older people have that same effect.
Yeah.
And you see this in the life of Gandhi.
Yeah.
In his old age, in his fasting, people saw his frailty not as a as something to be sorry about, but something that spoke a lot of power to power to authority. There's another phrase for that. I can't think of what it is.
Truth to power.
Truth to power. Yeah. And so. I think that older people can have the same impact, even if you were to go sit in on the city hall meetings at a great abundance and say, this is not going to stand. It may not be outside in this 100-degree weather because it ain't going to be me either. I mean, you see me sitting here in a sweater, so I don't do heat.
Well, you're not sitting in the sweater because you don't do heat. You're sitting in the sweater because you're crazy.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. So, but, you know, I think that older people have a place because one is their experience and also it's their wisdom, your wisdom that can inspire even people like our mayor and police chief who may be younger and are just trying to get through their career.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So.
All right. And then when I think about this story, it's my lesson is entitled A Giant in the Valley. But who is the real giant? Is Goliath the only giant in this valley?
Hmm. Well, you answer that question.
I don't think so. I think that on that day, David becomes a giant because you have that whole discussion between David and Goliath is so powerful to me. Goliath says, "I'm going to tear you apart and rip you to shreds," and David said, "No, you're not even." Because I'm coming with, in the name of the Lord, you defied the armies of God, and tells that man, "I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to cut your head off." That's what this young man tells. I mean, that's just some strong, tough stuff. David is the giant.
So his actions.
His actions, his spirit. Mm-hmm. His spirit, his tenacity, his faith, his commitment to God. We think of the only giant being Goliath, but David becomes a giant. He's no longer just a young man with a slingshot. He's a giant. And what is so striking to me is after he kills Goliath, then the people of Judah and Israel start shouting and rejoicing and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, yeah right. Mm-hmm. You know, this young man goes out there, faces Goliath and does it, and then now all of a sudden you're all going to jump around and shout and rejoice and everything when you could have been out there fighting the battle yourself.
I don't know. That may be a little touchy because that's how most things end up anyway. Wow. That there are only a few people who do the real work and everybody else comes in and rejoices. You see that in the church exactly all the time. Right. So
there's a faithful few, a remnant of people who are doing everything while everybody else is sitting on the sidelines. And listen, there are people who sit on the sidelines, but yet they say, it's my country. Or yet they say, it's my church. And they will take ownership of the church, but won't take leadership and won't contribute their time, their efforts, their resources to make it happen. But they, when the glory comes, they want to participate in the glory. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yes, yes.
So I raised this lesson today because, you know, I think we face Goliaths today. And Goliath today is not just a physical person, not just a human person, not just a giant. There are other Goliaths that we face today. What do you think?
I think so. There are many. Deacon Street came by yesterday and talked about the documentary called 13th.
Yeah.
Where you see there are a lot of systemic injustices. You see that there are a lot of different things that are happening all around the world that we have to face. And even if you don't believe that this is something to get uprooted about within your spirit and within your heart, then there are so many other things that we can take a stand for.
Yeah.
And there are going to be people fighting this fight for a long time, just as they already have been.
Yeah.
And so regardless, there should be something that we speak out or do as Christians, and we should get in the fight. And I do. I think there are a lot of different giants. But just like you said, just like David, there are people that have giant spirits and giant hearts and work
good
ethics.
Good point. Giant spirits, giant hearts. I like that.
What was your point?
Yeah, I think that racism is a giant.
Saying that was a good point because you made it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Racism is a giant injustice. And as you said, Terrence, this has been going on a long time. And we have been here before several times over. And the country has been here before several times over. And I think that sometimes these incidents give God an opportunity to open a window, and the country has a window now of opportunity to be able to make changes, to do something different about our police. And so who or what are the Davids of today? And the Davids are the people, as you say, with giant spirits, with giant hearts, who are willing to be in the battle, who are willing to go out there and face and confront racism, injustice, in you know, in any way that they can, and the Davids are not just preachers, not just churches. They're sororities, they're fraternities, they're community organizations, they're mom and pop store owners. They're people who live on our block in our neighborhoods, who say in the face of racism and injustice, you're defying God. You're defying the values of our faith, and we're going to stand against it, and we're going to do something about it.
I agree. And just like David, who was saying, this is too much. This equipment that you're trying to put on me is too much. going back to the last phrase, there are things that we have to realize what we're equipped for, and everybody is equipped differently. So you may not need all the armor that is coming out right now with racism, but choose your battle and know your capabilities, and don't be bogged down by the rhetoric. Do what you have to do and what you're capable of doing.
That's another insight that I missed that I thought is good that you brought out. David could not wear Saul's armor.
Right.
He hadn't. He wasn't accustomed to it. So that you can't do what everybody else can do. Mm-hmm. You can do what you can do. You can do what your within your capabilities and within the scope of your resources. So that's our lesson today, A Giant in the Valley. I hope that returning to something familiar was helpful. And as Reverend Spears has suggested, listening to your pastor read a passage of scripture, I hope it was inspirational for you today, beloved. Continue to pray for our bereaved families and for our world, for our country, and for what's going on with our police and our community, that God's grace might prevail.
Amen.
Amen. Anything else?
No, sir.
All right.
So today is June 10th. This coming up Sunday, which is the 14th, will be our commencement celebration Sunday. So please tune in, members and visitors who are joining with us online for our podcast. We will be celebrating our graduates and some of our college graduates as well. So please join with us for that. We also want to send a special shout out to the Durden family, Jaden Durden, Caleb Durden, who is no longer a member here, but always a member of Ebenezer. We wish you good luck, and we just want to give that shout out just in case we're not able to get his stuff in on Sunday. Also, be reminded, there was a be reminded about something.
Okay, while you're waiting on to be reminded, let me just mention we have an election on July 14th, and if you want to turn in a mail-in ballot application, it has to be received, not postmarked, by July 2nd for the July 14th primary runoff and special election.
Are you sure that's right? Yes. Because I got a text today that said it had to be postmarked by the 15th.
No, it said it has to be received, not postmarked, by July 2nd for the July 14th primary. That's what from Polly Street.
Okay. Because the text I got, just to read it, not saying it's accurate, the Texas state primary runoff. Oh, okay. July 14th. So it says in order to register by mail to vote in this election, your registration form must be postmarked by June 15th.
Right. So yeah.
All right. Well, I can't remember what I was going to say, but anyway, well, blessings to you.
That happens with young age.
Yeah, and old people. Goodbye.